Welcome to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is a show of the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition offered here on KKRN, community-supported radio. I'm Sharon Brizzolari, your host, and on this show, we interview a range of people who are interested in the criminal legal system, working outside of the system, or as is the case with my guest today, within the system. So today I have the pleasure and honor of speaking to Superior Court Judge Benjamin Hanna. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We always begin with our guests introducing themselves however they would like.
Well, sure. Well, thank you, Sharon. First of all, it's a great pleasure to be here. I know oftentimes in my job, we don't get to speak to the public because of the jobs that we do. But it's a real pleasure under circumstances like this to talk to you and your listeners. My name is Ben Hanna, or Benjamin Hanna, as they call me in court. I'm a Superior Court Judge in Shasta County, and I have been a Superior Court Judge in Shasta County for about 2.5 years. I was appointed by Governor Newsom in 2023, and I currently have a civil assignment with the Superior Court. I have been in Shasta County for quite a long time. I've worked and lived in Shasta County since early 2001, spent most of my career with the Shasta County District Attorney's Office. Briefly in 2023, worked for the Attorney General's Office out of Sacramento. And then, of course, since the summer of 2023, I've been with the courts. So I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to try to demystify some of the questions people might have about our court system.
Did you always think about being a judge, or what drew you to wanting to serve in that way?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I was actually talking to a group of students last week in my courtroom, and they asked me a similar question. I think it's really important, particularly for young people coming up and deciding what they want to do with their career, to kind of see how their career is going to progress. I didn't really even want to be an attorney or a lawyer until I was about to graduate from college with a bachelor's degree, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I thought to myself, maybe I'll just keep going to school. So I went to law school, became an attorney. I've always been really interested in the criminal justice system, wanted to be in the criminal justice system. So I sort of set my sights towards being a prosecutor, ended up in Shasta County DA's office just sort of by happenstance. They're really the first person that offered me a job as a prosecutor. And then over the course of my career, I worked my way up through the office, did a lot of different things in the DA's office. You know, I'm not one of those lawyers that says from the first time I was an attorney, I wanted to be a judge. It sort of just evolved over time. Mm-hmm. As you know, probably those attorneys who work in the criminal justice system, whether they be prosecutors or criminal defense attorneys, spend a lot of time in the courtroom. You know, not all attorneys do that, but I was able to get a lot of experience in the courtroom doing jury trials, appearing in front of a lot of really good judges in Shasta County. And, you know, over time, I kind of thought that maybe that's a direction I wanted to go. And I went that way. Took me a while to get the position, but I'm really happy with it. And I tell people it's the best job I ever had.
You mentioned that you knew you wanted to work in the criminal legal system. And certainly one can do that from a number of different arenas. What was it about the criminal justice system that really drew you to wanting to be involved?
A lot of it is just interesting. You're dealing with a lot of drama, a lot of interesting fact patterns. And so I liked it from sort of the excitement side of things, at least initially. But over time, as I worked in the criminal justice system, I see that there's a real potential for doing good. And it doesn't, you don't have to be a prosecutor. You could be a criminal defense attorney, the same thing. You're doing good. You're serving a client. In the case of a prosecutor, you're trying to help, you know, people who may have been a victim of a crime. In the case of a criminal defense attorney, you're representing someone who's accused of a crime. The criminal justice system, I like to say, is reactive rather than proactive, which means, you know, we get involved after something bad has already happened. I think that there's been a shift over the years to be a little bit more proactive and try to prevent things from happening in the first place in the criminal justice system. But you're dealing with people in very difficult places, and I always appreciated trying to help and make the situation a little bit better, even though I couldn't, make it back to the way it was.
Tremendous amount of vulnerability and fear. And
right.
You also mentioned at the beginning your assignment. And my understanding is that the presiding judge makes a decision about who's assigned to what cases. And you mentioned you have had the assignment of civil case. Has that been since you were appointed?
Yeah, judge? I've consistently had a civil assignment. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because I have zero background in civil law or civil litigation. My entire career has been spent in the criminal side of things. And judicial assignments, as you indicated, are, you know, made by the presiding judge. But obviously he or she gets people's input into what they would like to do or what they're interested in. I was in a little bit of a unique situation in that because I had been in the district attorney's office for so long, because I was a pretty high-level supervisor in the district attorney's office, I would have had a lot of conflict cases that I would have had to not be, would not have been able to hear because of the fact that I was a prosecutor. So that really necessitated me being placed in a situation other than a criminal assignment. So that was part of the reason I ended up in a civil assignment. I have to say I'm going to stay there for at least the near future. There's no chance or plans for me to move out of the civil assignment, and I really enjoy it. It's a very challenging, a lot of information, a lot of types of cases that I deal with. But you know, from coming from not having done any civil background at all to doing this, I'm really enjoying it.
What's been the most surprising for you, or has captured more of your attention?
Yeah, you know, I guess the thing that surprised me the most coming from a criminal practitioner's background is just the variety of civil cases. You know, there's a huge amount of variety. We think of, you know, people suing someone for money damages for a car accident or a personal injury type of situation. And of course, there's quite a bit of that. But we deal with property disputes. We deal with different types of, you know, water rights and property and contracts and business disputes. The civil assignment is very widely varied, and there's a lot of different kinds of cases that I deal with. And so it really requires me to learn a lot of different areas of law that I may not have had experience with as a practitioner.
I mean, how much support do you have? We've heard a lot about the challenges in the funding and capacity of, which I'm going to ask you about later,
right,
of different departments, but...
Yeah, so I have a really great, the Superior Court has really great staff. You know, everyone thinks about the judges and they're sort of the face of the group or the face of the court, but we have a tremendous staff all the way from clerks to administrative folks and everyone in between. In the civil division, I'm fortunate enough to be assisted by some research attorneys who do a lot of assistance with a lot of the motions and legal issues I have to deal with. And so they make my job quite a bit easier because they do a lot of legal research and provide me with memos and things like that that really help me do this. It wouldn't be sustainable without the staff that we have, for sure. I see a little bit of everything every day.
You're in court how many times a week?
So it really depends. My normal court day, my calendar, we call it a calendar, is when you hear, you know, a huge number of cases. My primary calendar day is Monday. So that will be the day that I hear, you know, anywhere from 50 to 60 cases potentially. But then the rest of the week is set aside for trials. So they could be very short trials that, you know, may involve limited issues. They could be a trial that's tried just to the judge, a bench trial or a court trial, you call it. Or I could also be involved in jury trials. It's Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays are the trial days. And of course, the jury trials could, you know, go over to additional weeks. And then Fridays are the days I'm try to stay out of court because that's I'm preparing for the next week, preparing for Monday. Oftentimes, if based on, you know, just the fact that there's nowhere else to put a case, sometimes I'll end up hearing some stuff on Fridays as well.
Mm-hmm. And how many Superior Court judges does Shasta County have? And is that, what is the number based on?
Yeah, so right now we have a total of 13, we call bench officers or combination of Superior Court commissioners and Superior Court judges. 11 of those are judges, and we have two commissioners. And the number of judges that a particular county has is based on what they call a judicial needs assessment. And periodically, the state court system is run by an organization called the Judicial Council of California. They do these judicial needs assessments, which basically say how many judges does a particular county need based upon the number of cases that they have. And that's really the metric that's really the thing that's that drives it. And Shasta County, based upon the number of cases we have, has been designated to have 11 judges, with two commissioners we have as well. I think we are probably in the next judicial needs assessment, I wouldn't be surprised if they say that we need more positions. Of course, that doesn't create the position. It has to be created and funded by the legislature. It's just a recommendation from the Judicial Council that a certain county needs additional judges, and we certainly are one of the busiest. If you go by, per capita or cases per judge, Shasta County is actually probably in the top five in the state as far as one of the most busy courts.
Yeah, I had heard that, and that's still the case, that the caseloads are above average, above average.
I would say that that's probably true. I think it's definitely, we have quite a few cases per bench officer, yeah.
What contributes to that?
Yeah, it's hard to say, because we're in a position is basically, we're there to take whatever case somebody has. We're not in a position to create cases. We don't turn cases down. So obviously the sources of our cases, the majority of the cases we deal with are criminal cases. That could be anything from a traffic ticket all the way up to a serious, violent offense like murder or robbery or something of that nature. And I think people get a lot of attention. The criminal cases get a lot of attention, particularly in our county.
Right.
But we also have to be there to be available to deal with other types of cases. Civil cases, such as the ones I deal with, are very important. They're very important. Property disputes and rights that people have that are at issue. A significant amount of our resources go towards family court, because those are so important. You're dealing with issues of divorces, custody, visitation, assets, and people need to have those cases addressed. We have a probate court. We have guardianship court. And it's just a function of, we have a lot of cases filed in this county, and we have to be able to serve the public and resolve them as quickly as we can.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio. I'm your host, Sharon Brizolera, and I'm in conversation with Superior Court Judge Ben Hanna. You said we have 11 judges. Are all those seats filled, or do we have vacant seats?
So up until a couple months ago, we had two vacancies. We had two retirements in, I think, May or June of last year. Two of our longstanding judges retired, and so their positions were vacant. Most of the time, the governor fills those vacant positions, and he takes as much time as he needs to do that. We had a judge appointed, and he took office, I think, in February, late January or early February. That's Judge Patrick Deedon. This year. Mm-hmm. He filled one of those spots. And then a couple weeks ago, we received a notice that the last position that was open was Governor Newsom appointed a local attorney to fill that spot, and he'll be taking office at the end of this month in late March.
So, okay, and then things will be full.
Then we'll be fully staffed with our 11 judges, right? And we're very much, me and my colleagues are very much looking forward to that.
I'm sure. And you mentioned that a review might lead to, if there is funding, creation of additional positions.
Right.
I know this is a hard question, but how many judges would we need to have to not have the fifth largest caseload in the state?
Yeah, that would be difficult to say. And without, crunching the numbers, I couldn't tell you that. Sure. We're also limited, though. It's not just a matter of judges, you have to remember. It's space to put those judges. It's staff. It's not just a judge in a courtroom is able to do the job by himself or herself. As I indicated, we couldn't run without our staff. So, just in my example and most other courts' examples, I have a clerk with me in the courtroom. I have a bailiff in the courtroom. Those positions are needed as well. There's also a lot of support people that work behind the scenes. So it's a combination of space and staffing as well as judges. So it's a really holistic approach. And it's not, you know, just saying that we need more judges, which sometimes I think the public sees that because, like I said, the judges are the face of the court.
Sure, sure.
It's not quite as simple as that. But we do everything we can do to try to get everyone's case heard and, you know, fairly adjudicate all the disputes that come before us. Because at the end of the day, that's what we're here for. We're here to hear people's disputes and try to resolve them if we can.
Right. Well, and I definitely hear the part about staffing and whatnot. Thinking about the new courthouse, which I have not been in yet, was that created with growth in mind?
Yeah. So the new courthouse, obviously, it's designed to be something that the court will be in for decades to come. And so, you know, there is, I think, the ability to use the space we have should we need to expand. It is a marked improvement to the old building that we had on Court Street. You know, I was fortunate during the most of the time I practiced in Shasta County to practice in that old courthouse. I have a lot of sentimental feelings towards it. And interestingly, because the new courthouse wasn't done, I actually served as a judge for about 6 months in the old courthouse as well before we moved. So I can tell you it's night and day. The new courthouse is much superior to the old courthouse. But yeah, we're going to be there for a while. It's built to, you know, last. It's built to hopefully expand in as the needs of the county grow, as the population grows. You know, that's the needs of the county grow in all types of government services.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell from the outside, and I have been within the old ones. Yeah, it's a beautiful building.
It's a great building. I really enjoy it. You know, it's definitely a definite improvement on what we were dealing with before.
Last year, the Board of Supervisors, I believe, convened a evening where different department heads came together, the sheriff, the chief of police for Reading, probation, DA, all came to speak about some of the capacity needs, some of the limitations, a lot of it based on funding and helping the public and also the Board of Supervisors understand how it impacted their ability to serve in a way that they're intended. So we heard a lot about data systems, data collection, staffing that I'm sure affects all of the system. Aside from the, you know, what you mentioned in terms of more judges and more space, are there other capacity issues relying on funding that we as a public should be concerned about when we think about the efficacy of the Superior Court system?
Yeah, I mean, you know, particularly in the criminal system, obviously the stakeholders are primarily your law enforcement agencies and your prosecuting agency, in our case, the Shasta County District Attorney. And of course, you know, we have a public criminal defense office, the public defender's office. It's important that those individuals or those offices be staffed, that they are able to efficiently bring the cases that they need to bring within their discretion. It's not the court's position to tell the DA that she can't prosecute a particular case or shouldn't prosecute a particular case. That's outside our jurisdiction. I took that hat off when I stopped being a DA a couple years ago, and I'm happy to let the DA use that discretion. So from the court's perspective, we're just trying to do everything we can to make sure that we fairly and efficiently process those cases that come before us, and we do the best we can. But I think, you know, we have very close collaboration with all of our criminal justice stakeholders in the court. I'm not so much involved in that anymore because of my civil assignment, but right. I'm familiar with the fact that our administration and our criminal judges are frequently meeting with those stakeholders to try to figure out efficiencies, try to figure out ways that things can be done more efficiently. And we're constantly going to do everything we can within our role, obviously, as a, you know, impartial arbiter of the facts to try to make the system run as smoothly as possible.
Well, what was your sense when you were in the DA's office, and what's your sense now of what we're not able to do without the kind of funding that the workload requires?
Yeah, so I will tell you, and I'm not ashamed to say this, that I've had a little bit of a change in attitude since I've moved into this branch of government. When I was in the district attorney's office, you know, obviously you believe that the criminal cases are the most important, and why can't the court dedicate all of its resources towards criminal cases? And obviously I'm in a different situation now, and I'm not involved in a criminal assignment. I'm involved in a civil assignment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just is not appropriate and is not efficient for us to develop, to devote so all of our resources towards criminal cases, because as I said before, we have to provide access to justice to people who are dealing with family law matters, probate matters, civil matters as well. So I think the court already dedicates quite a few resources towards criminal cases. We have essentially every week we have 4 to 5 criminal courts that are running jury trials as on a week by week basis. And that's a pretty significant amount of our resources that we're dedicating towards criminal cases. But obviously, you know, I'll leave the funding and the manpower decisions for those individuals who run their offices. But I think efficiency by everybody is important so that we're not wasting time spinning our wheels on things that, that don't get us towards the finish line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when you were mentioning earlier, and it's something that, that I had heard, I wanted to check out with you, that our average caseload for judges is so high, and a lot of things are being brought to trial, and we are likely have many things that in other circumstances might be brought to trial if we had more resources. If all of those came to trial, and we're already fifth in the state...
And it's important to, you know, not every case goes to trial,
sure.
Right? And so obviously every single case that's filed does not go to trial. And when I say trial, it's, you know, a hearing where someone decides in a criminal case guilty or not guilty, either a judge or a jury based upon presentation of evidence and the law. You know, that's why we have a plea bargain system in the criminal justice system where people resolve cases short of trial. Well over 90% of all criminal cases, I think it is, resolve without going to trial. And similarly in civil cases too, you know, people are suing someone for money damages and, you know, they come to a resolution and they settle the case. It happens a lot, but, you know, we try to facilitate that as well. My colleagues and I, to the extent that these cases are before us, we're trying to, you know, see if we can have the parties come to the table, and come up with some mutually agreeable disposition that's going to, settle the case in a way that's, you know, both sides can live with and also, you know, is one less case that we have to take to trial.
What might be different in those counties that maybe are similar to us in terms of demographics or and have much lower...
A lot of it just has to do with you know, the attitudes of the players in the criminal justice system. And when I say attitude, I don't mean that in a negative way.
Sure.
But, you know, our district attorney's office has the discretion to file the cases that they do. Some district attorney's offices may have different ideas or policies about how to follow or how to file cases and what they file. The district attorney is an independently elected official in our county, and she's accountable to the voters, and she makes those decisions. And it's not my job as a judge to second guess those. Mm-hmm. I always tell people, and it sounds kind of silly to say, but I see the court system is really a customer service situation. We have customers that come to our courts, customers in the form of litigants or lawyers who have something that they bring to us that they need us to resolve, and it's our job to resolve them. So, you know, I've only ever practiced in Shasta County. I've only ever worked as a judge in Shasta County, so I don't have a whole lot of insight into how things are done in the other 57 counties in California. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is just discretionary on the DA and the public defender and how they want to deal with the cases that are assigned to them.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that when we were doing the State of Equity report, which we did not involve the DA's office in that first round, but we looked at a lot of data about our incarceration rates, which I know also is not your,
right.
You're not out arresting people, but our incarceration rate is particularly high, and which I'm guessing could affect I mean, then you are in the system, right? And then that might be more likely to make its way to the DA. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of good statistics and research that people have done about recidivism and ways to, you know, minimize recidivism. I said at the beginning, traditionally, the criminal justice system has been really reactive as opposed to proactive. I think in the last 10 or 15 years that I've been involved in the criminal justice system, we've been moving away from that, you know, trying to work towards rehabilitative efforts, which I think in the long run are not only good for the offender, but they're also good for the community because it costs less to the community, puts people back into the community and positively contributing. So to the extent that you know, those programs are out there and available and able to be taken advantage of under the law, I think it's a good thing because, you know, like a lot, incarceration obviously it has a huge impact on the person incarcerated as well as their loved ones. But as a member of the community, it's a cost issue too. And I think that that's something that people have started to think about too.
You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio. I'm your host, Sharon Brizolera, and I'm in conversation with Superior Court Judge Ben Hanna. Would it be fair to say the, you know, DA has a certain amount of discretion and they're beholden to the voters, and is that a similar situation when it comes to arrest as the sheriff? The chief of police is not elected, but certainly right. Has to respond to the community.
Yeah. And I mean, I think in those situations, you know, I've never worked as a police officer, but of course I worked very closely with law enforcement agencies over my career. And, you know, they're responding to what their public wants. You know, if there's a particular crime that's happening in a particular part of town, the citizens are going to go after the sheriff or go after the chief of police and tell him, hey, this is something that we'd like you to focus on. Obviously, they can only do what they can do, but a lot of it is driven by public demand and public opinion in a lot of ways. But also, we have very professional law enforcement agencies in Shasta County, and they, you know, do the best with the resources that they have. And I you know, worked with a lot of them when I was a prosecutor, and am confident that it's not my job to tell them how to do their job, mm-hmm. and they can do it just fine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you're highlighting the importance of the public voice, and it makes me think about who is expressing their opinions about the kind of justice system that we want. Is it your sense that the DA's office, which is you're most familiar with, and to the extent that you know sort of the sheriff's office, is more likely to hear from people who talk about accountability rather than rehabilitative responses?
You know, I don't know that that's necessarily true. I think over the time I was in the DA's office, we really tried to involve folks from all different viewpoints. Mm. Obviously, we worked closely with the probation department, mm-hmm. Closely with the probation department, which has a lot of rehabilitative efforts that it's involved with. So mm-hmm. I think it's just as a trend overall in the last, you know, several years in California, not just in other parts of the state or more urban parts of the state, but even in more rural parts of the state, such as Shasta County, we're hearing more and more from people that are interested in some more of that rehabilitative type mindset.
Hmm. So we do have collaborative courts here. And before we talk about those, could you explain to folks what a collaborative court is, what that means?
Yeah. So I was fortunate enough when I was in the district attorney's office to be assigned as a prosecutor representative to a couple of different collaborative courts. Collaborative courts are kind of what their name implies, is more of a situation as opposed to your typical adversarial situation where you have a prosecutor who is trying to prosecute someone and trying to, you know, get them to be sentenced to a particular sentence, and a criminal defense attorney who is trying to represent them and, you know, help them to minimize their exposure. Collaborative courts involve not just a DA and a defense attorney, but a court, a judge, service providers in the community. It could be drug or alcohol counselors, probation department, basically all working together in a collaborative way that tries to really keep a focus on rehabilitation. The collaborative court that I worked with the most is called the Addicted Offender Program. A lot of places call those a drug court. And basically it was for individuals who were facing some pretty significant consequences based upon, alleged crimes that they'd committed. And they agreed to essentially accept responsibility for those offenses, but go into this court. And it's a really demanding process. They work really hard. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for those folks who successfully complete those collaborative courts, because we put them through their paces and they do really good work. And it's really rewarding. And I just went, I'm not involved in the court as part of my job, but periodically, Judge Dan Flynn, who is our representative in the Addicted Offender Program, he sends out notices to us about the graduations of people graduating from the program. I still love to attend those. I just attended one a couple weeks ago, and it's, really gratifying to see how hard people work. People are able to really mend their relationships. You know, when you're in the throes of your addiction, you really destroy the relationships you have with your family, your children, your friends. And it's really gratifying to see how hard those folks work to get those back. It's a really one of the situations in the criminal justice system where you can really be proud that people are really being rehabilitated and going on to do great things in our community. So I enjoyed my time with the collaborative courts and I hope in some capacity, even in the future, maybe to be involved with them again.
Yeah, I've been to a couple of those graduations. They are very powerful and really inspiring. Often when we talk about those efforts, someone will ask about how successful are they? And often below that question is a question about rates or kind of a cost-benefit analysis. I'm wondering for you how you would measure success of the program and what you think goes into helping it be successful for folks.
Yeah, I think it's easy to sort of take a 30,000-foot view and say, look, tell me your statistics, tell me right. Your data. What do you have that shows that this is a good program? And I'm not saying that there's not a role for that. Obviously, we don't want to be spending our scarce resources on things that, aren't working. But I measure success sort of on the more granular level, on the level I see, where I see kids who had no relationship with their mom or their dad now have a relationship with their mom or dad. Parents who thought that they had lost their son or their daughter to their addiction now having a relationship with them. The amount of time I've been involved in seeing these programs over the last probably I've been participating for at least, 10 or 15 years in one way or the other. I'm firmly convinced that, it's successful and it's worth the resources. And the court wouldn't be involved if we didn't think it was something that was worthwhile. Similarly, those other stakeholders in the collaborative courts, the DA, the public defender, the probation department, the drug and alcohol service providers, they wouldn't be involved if they didn't think it was worthwhile, because why would you participate in a program that you didn't think was effective? So I really think it's the personal levels, the personal stories to hear people that really makes you think, this is something that we need to keep on doing.
Mm-hmm. And we also have a mental health or behavioral health court.
We do.
And how does that function? What have you seen develop there?
Yeah, so the behavioral health court is smaller than the Addicted Offender Program. It has just because it's got fewer participants, but it's basically a similar model where individuals who have committed crimes, but are suffering from some mental health diagnosis, really work to try to get those issues addressed. And, you know, if they're successful, they're able to move on from those criminal offenses. I worked a little bit briefly with that program in the DA's office, although most of my time was with the Addicted Offender Program. But of course, you know, substance abuse and mental health issues often go hand in hand. You know, we talk about people with what they call a dual diagnosis. So oftentimes, you know, you're addressing in both of those issues and trying to help people be successful. The Care Court's a separate situation, and that's really a state-mandated program. I don't say state-mandated in a negative way, but that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And that was the project that was spearheaded by the governor a couple years ago, and essentially it allows people to refer an individual to the Care Court who they think, you know, would benefit from it. Oftentimes it's people that might be experiencing homelessness and as a result of some sort of, you know, substance issue or mental health diagnosis. I'm not super familiar with how the Care Court works. It's not my in my bandwidth, so to speak, in my assignment, but we do have a judge who's assigned to that. And from what I've read, just anecdotally, news articles statewide, we're beginning to get additional participants in it, but it's a little bit been slow to get off the ground and for various reasons.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of public debate and people on both sides and some very passionate, often parents of young people and as well as people in the mental health system who have some concerns. And it's a huge lift for sure. Is there anything either within or external to the courts that in your sense would help increase the efficacy of those courts or perhaps increase their capacity? Things that if you were in charge of everything, you might change or enhance?
Well, I think, you know, obviously if we had more funding available, that could be, we could serve more people. I think that if we had more resources, obviously that's going to be something that would enable us to put more people through the program. But, you know, beyond that, it's just a matter of finding the right folks that are the right fit for the program. Because as I said, it's not easy. And, you know, the people who deserve the credit for the success of these collaborative courts aren't people like me and my colleagues or the DAs or the public defenders. It's really the participants, and because they're the ones that put themselves out there to be successful. So I think, you know, public knowledge about these programs is good. I think we have a pretty fair, at least in our county, get the word out about the fact that these programs exist. You know, periodically we hear about them through news releases or whatever, but I think public education is important too in knowing that, you know, that this type of program is out there and available.
Mm-hmm. In what other ways do judges have some purview in encouraging a more restorative justice type approach? Like, is sentencing, how you approach sentencing, one of those ways?
Yeah, you know, again, this is more of a criminal judge kind of situation. Sure. But we have to be real careful in what we say or what we do as judges. Our job is to follow the law that we're given and the sentencing guidelines that come to us from Sacramento in making a sentencing decision in a criminal case. You know, I just had a jury trial a couple weeks ago, a civil jury trial, and I explained to the jury as we were selecting the jury, your job as jurors is to follow the law even if you don't agree with it. And I asked people if they would commit to do that. I do that every time I pick a jury. And, you know, that sounds kind of weird in the abstract. Why should I have to promise that? But that's because it's a different function. It's a different branch of government. And, you know, just as the jurors are not able to make up the law as that they think or that they like, me as a judge, I have to follow the law wherever it leads me. And so to the extent that those laws deal with sentencing issues, we have to exercise that discretion and follow the law as it's provided to us. But, you know, to a certain extent, sometimes we might have some input on some of those laws, but generally we try to steer clear of that. As a branch of government, you know, co-equal third branch of government that's designed to be neutral and impartial, it's really important that we do that.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio. I'm your host, Sharon Brizolera, and I'm in conversation with Superior Court Judge Ben Hanna. So you just said a lot, and
right.
One of the things that has been so concerning for me, the rule of law seems to be undermined in itself. We're seeing more instances as a resident of people suggesting things that are not currently the law, and seeing, well, let's see how it goes, and if the court tells us differently, we'll address that. Without speaking of certain cases, what is the danger that we face as, let's just say, as a country, when that becomes more normalized?
Yeah, it's we live, you know, no, everyone can see we live in a very politically polarized place right now in this mm-hmm. country. And, you know, you ask 50 people why that is, you're going to get 50 different opinions. But, this concept of the rule of law is so important because it ensures that all people are treated equally under the law, no matter who they are. Now, it's aspirational. Many times in our country's history, you know, judges have not lived up to that. I can imagine there's been many times that that's happened. But I think it's really important for me as a representative of, as I said before, that third co-equal branch of government, the judicial branch, to really explain to people how important the rule of law is. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and misconception about how the judicial branch works. And a lot of that's based on the fact that, you know, we're not able to get out there like the, you know, what people call the political branches, your executive, your legislative, and tell people what our opinions are and lobby and talk about that kind of stuff. So to the extent we can, one of the responsibilities that all judges in California actually have under our ethics code is to provide education to the community on legal issues, on the rule of law. And I know that every single judge that I work with, every single bench officer that I work with in my court, and those I know across the state take that obligation very seriously, because, you know, that is a fundamental issue in our country, is making sure that we have the rule of law. If you read, you know, not to nerd out and get too far out into the weeds, but if you read, you know, the founders and how they decided to create the what we call the Article III courts in the U.S. Constitution, the federal court system in Article III, it was designed to have the courts be free from influence from, you know, other parties. Now, obviously, that's not 100% doable. Judges are influenced, but you know, from the founders on down to the California Constitution continuously emphasized the rule of law is important, and that all parties deserve a fair shake in the courtroom. And that's what, you know, when someone comes into my court, that's all I can tell them is I'm going to give them a fair hearing. And, you know, my goal when someone walks out of my courtroom is they might not like the decision that I made because they don't agree with me. You know, 50% of the time someone's going to win and someone's going to lose, right? But at least I hope that I've explained to them why I've done what I've done, and based on the law, and not based upon the fact that, you know, I don't like them or I don't like their lawyer or whatever else. So mm-hmm. That's kind of a long way to say it, but I think it's really important that you know, just basic civics education in our country is so important on judicial issues, judicial branch, and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. And that there are ways, if a law seems unjust or has become unjust or does not take into account a population that was not taken into account before,
right,
that there are vehicles for
There are avenues to deal with that, of course. Yeah, for mm-hmm. sure.
So one issue that I know you can't talk about specifics, but that's come up in our county, and by the time we air this, it may have changed once, you know, what's being discussed about it, but we had a measure that was going to be in our election in June, the voter ID, hand-counted ballots, and absentee voting limits initiative. And you ruled on it that it needed to be held because some of the provisions worked against existing election law at the state.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I can't comment on anything that involves a case that's currently before me. Mm-hmm. So not to give you the Stonewall treatment, but sure. I'm giving you the Stonewall treatment on
sure.
that one.
Sure.
It's just beyond what we're able to do, and that just wouldn't be appropriate for me to talk about that.
Sure. Ruling on an issue where there are positions things that go against existing law. I'm guessing that's not the first time that something has come before you.
Well, you know, every day judges are dealing with people who come before us and have different interpretations of what they think the law is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're often good faith interpretations. Two people read a particular fact pattern or a statute and say, this is what I think this means and you should rule in my favor, Judge. Mm-hmm. Our job is really, it's simple and it's complicated at the same time, is to look at the law and look at the facts and make the determination as to what the law says based upon the particular facts in front of us. And again, it goes back to that concept we talked about a little while ago, the rule of law, in that, you know, we're to apply the law neutrally without any decision on what our own personal preference is. And that's really all we can do. And, you know, judges do the best with the law and the facts that they have before them. We have levels of courts in this state and in this country to review decisions that judges have made. And, you know, hopefully we get it right more than we get it wrong.
Mm-hmm. So in those cases, what you're saying is that you are applying the rule of law. You're making sure that the court following the rule of law, regardless of what comes before, you are ruling based on existing law, and that there are procedures for checking that. Correct?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, like I said, all I'm trying to do is get it right based on the facts and the law before me. And you know, anybody who is not satisfied with my decision obviously has a way to have another court look at that. And that doesn't bother me in the slightest, because that's the way the system is set up. But we just do the best we can with the facts and the law that we have in front of us.
Mm-hmm. You talked about educating, and certainly in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, those of us concerned about how things are working, about justice, have seen a great need for education about the law, general civics, how elections work. And we have groups like the League of Women Voters who do some of that education. Since you're here, do you have any great ideas about what groups like the League of Women Voters or others could do in the current environment to educate people or to direct them to reputable, user-friendly resources to learn more about how things operate?
Yeah, you mentioned the League of Women Voters. I was privileged a couple months ago to speak to them, and I think that that's a great organization. I think a lot of it has to do with just dealing with educating the public on at an early level, talking about schools. You know, as time permits, I like to try to talk to students and get them excited about civics and how our government works and how the system works. I think it's real important for people to just educate themselves on just how different processes work, how different, how a bill becomes a law. And there's a lot of government websites and resources out there that provide that information. You know, the Judicial Council of California, the California Courts website really has a lot of information on there, primarily directed towards people who might be representing themselves in litigation, but a lot of real basic information on how to get a case in court. And I think it's just incumbent on those of us who are in the system, judges, people who are involved in the criminal justice system or the civil justice system, to just provide, be that voice, be that party who can try to educate. And, you know, I see a big part of what my job is to really be in that education or teaching mode, you know, and I think particularly it starts with students, it starts with young people, and that's really something that I think is important.
Mm-hmm. You know, among our group, there are folks who are concerned about existing laws or policies related to protections for law enforcement officers. And many will ask me, you know, if I'm speaking to someone like you, to ask about what should give us confidence that a case that's brought by on a law enforcement officer who's perhaps, there's a question of whether or not they've broken a law, is treated as fairly as any other case. Again, this is maybe more criminal law. It could be civil law, but I would love to get your perspective on that.
Well, all I can tell you is that, you know, people in my position do everything we can to be fair and impartial to anybody who comes before us as a plaintiff or as a defendant, a criminal defendant. And again, it's just going to be based upon the facts and the law and where that leads us. I understand, you know, public perceptions. I can't do anything to change people's perceptions. People are entitled to their viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the ultimate remedy for that is that our justice system work in as transparent a way as possible. And that's really how our justice system works. We don't have private courts. We don't have confidential courts. I mean, we do under certain circumstances for very good reasons, for example, involving, you know, juveniles. But everything that I do in my courtroom is open to the light of day. Anybody who wants to come and see what I'm doing can come into my courtroom and watch. Might not be the most interesting thing that they've seen all day, but it is open and transparent, and everything we do is subject to review. And we are officials who are responsible to the public as well. So, you know, there's that level of accountability that's there, and we just do our best to treat everyone fairly and try the cases in front of us with the same level of fairness, no matter who the person is.
Mm-hmm. You were appointed in 2023, but it's an elected position, right?
Yeah, so most judges in California end up initially in office via the appointment process appointed by the governor. Occasionally, if a judge retires at the end of his or her term, it'll be up for an election and the governor won't have an opportunity to fill it. But all judges are ultimately subject to being elected. So I was appointed in 2023, but in March of 2024, I was on the ballot to be elected because of the cycle that I was in.
Mm.
So I've actually already been elected once. Judges in California serve 6-year terms, so I'll next be on the ballot, I think, in 2030.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are also along the lines of what we talk about, you know, more polarized. There's a lot of attention paid to positions that, say, 10 years ago, people didn't really pay much attention to. If people were interested in finding out more about a judge's work, where would they go? What's a good way to do that?
Yeah, so as I said, we're public employees, and everything we do is transparent. But obviously not every case we hear is going to be something that people are going to know about because it's just a large volume of it, and most of it doesn't have a whole lot of public, you know, interest other than to the parties in the case. I think judges who hear cases, oftentimes you're able to research them on the internet, find out who they are, what kind of cases that they've had before them. I think it's just all about being an educated member of the electorate. But again, mm-hmm. if you have any interest or any desire to know what happens in a courtroom, the best way to deal with that, obviously subject to your own time limitations, is to come and watch mm-hmm. or serve on a jury. You know, I've had individuals who serve on juries in my courtroom, and I think that they gain a real good understanding of how the system works from being there. I always tell them, you know, we're hiring you to be temporary employees of the judicial branch to try this case. And it's really eye-opening, I think. And I try to make it a positive experience. But everything we do is public, and people are more than entitled to follow up and you know, attend court and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. It is an incredible education, serving on a jury. So we've talked about a number of different things, and we could talk about 12 more if we had the time, which we don't. But is there anything that I should have asked you or that you wanted to talk about that we could address now?
I think the biggest, you know, takeaway for perhaps you and your listeners is that the judicial branch of government shouldn't be mysterious. We want people to know what we do. We don't do things in secret. And I'm really privileged to work with a great group of folks who work really hard to provide the citizens of Shasta County with justice every day. It's just a tremendous honor to have this position. And I know that speaking on behalf of my colleagues, they'd feel the same way, that it's an honor and a privilege to serve, and it's not something that we take for granted. And so I really appreciate folks like you and your organization giving us this opportunity to speak, because so often people don't really have a clear understanding of judges and what they do and why they do things. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, we can't comment on cases or pending cases or cases mm-hmm. that might be coming before us, and that limits us a little bit. But it's a real privilege to serve the community and just provide maybe a little bit of a window into the work we do. And so I appreciate that, and thank you for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've really appreciated what I've heard from you when you were at the DA's office or also on the Juvenile Justice Coordinating Council. You spoke about being interested in the drama, but you have such a calm demeanor and you're such a good listener and very interested and concerned about restorative practices, which is really important to me as well. So thank you for bringing that to us.
You're welcome. I'm happy to do it.
You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio.
Can't let go. No, I can't let go. Memories long ago. Remember these. I can't let go. Remind me, please. Who am I, though? I don't believe I can't. No, I can't let go. No, I can't let go. I can't get high, and I can't get low.